You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahiahi Māori e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toku ingoa.
Ko Sophia toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
I'm good, I'm so happy that you're back with me.
Yeah, I'm pleased to be back.
I know, I was all on my lonesome last week. I held the fort down.
We can't have that. I'm never going to do that to you again. I'm so sorry.
Thank you.
But we're so back and we have a beautiful show. Maya, what have you got today?
Yeah, I caught up with artist Gian Manick, who is one of the three artists showing work within Gus Fisher's new group exhibition, Dreaming From Afar. So what have you got for today?
I caught up with co-director of Michael Lett Gallery, Andrew Thomas, about their current exhibition restaging Julian Dashba's mid-career survey exhibition, Midwestern Unlike You and Me, which originally took the American Midwest in 2005 and 2006.
He aha ofakaro, would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai, you can text us on 5395 5 5 5 5. Why mai rane, or give us a call in the studio on 309 3879.
Also after the show, kawa e ware ware e ahe ana kato te whakarongo ki e nei korero anō hei pakihere roki roki marangai te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Various Artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Dreaming From Afar is a new group exhibition showing at Gus Fisher Gallery, which brings together works from the practices of Gian Manick, Brunel Diaz-Prims and Tyrone Tewa. The show circulates the complexities of history and nostalgia through this painterly language that seeks to morph the physical with the imagined. Gian Manick is a Nam-based painter who produces mesmerizing works that play with various tropes preserved within the historical painting genres of still life, landscape and portraiture. Within Dreaming From Afar, Manick showcases a beautiful body of paintings that includes various methods of painterly application, intimate and finely rendered works on oil on canvas, as well as these lively frescoes that become one with the gallery space itself. The works themselves bring the works together Manick's fascination with historical painting and old masters, alongside his research and exploration of Orientalism and queer representation within art history, pulling these themes together in space to produce beautiful works that grapple with the entrenched hetero and ethnocentric hierarchies of the Western art canon. I caught up with Gian about the show and overall practice.
My name's Gian Manick and I'm an artist from Nam, Melbourne. So I'm primarily a painter, but I guess I sort of, you know, work within the kind of, I guess, the canon of painting and like in a more sort of, maybe sometimes experimental and sometimes quite traditional way.
Lovely. And you currently have a work showing within Gus Fisher's new group exhibition, Dreaming From Afar. Within the show, you present a beautiful body of paintings, yeah, that arise from this exploration of various tropes preserved within the history painting genres of still life, landscape, and portraiture. I wanted to start this conversation by asking, yeah, where this kind of pull towards historical paintings came from for you? Was it something that you were exposed to throughout your early life or kind of found yourself later on?
Yeah, I think I've sort of come from a very, I guess, like an arc of having painting around. Like from a very young age, my mum was a painter and my granddad, her father, was a painter. And I think that we had, like, you know, books, like this series called The Great Artists. And I kind of, you know, I felt like I almost started studying and painting traditionally with oil paints from such a young age.
Wow.
In a way where it wasn't sort of kind of forced upon me, but I enjoyed it. Dissimilar to like sports. But I think that, like, kind of circling back to, you know, really traditional tropes and historical painting and, you know, this idea of kind of like studying, I think, is the word that I like to use, as opposed to sort of copying or reclamation or something a bit more sort of politicized. But yeah, I think that, you know, I've seen my practice probably from you know, the last 20 years is exploration into sort of self-portraiture. I know a lot of artists use that as like a kind of umbrella term. And I think within that, I've sort of moved quite organically from one kind of series or study to the other.
Yeah.
And I think kind of circling back to this more sort of traditional, recognisable, kind of historical, you know, visual language, I think, you know, talks to that kind of lineage and heritage where I come from. But then also I think it's also, you know, I try to sort of complicate that and challenge it from my personal perspective, which is the other sort of self-portraiture kind of thing, where identity kind of, I guess, politics, for lack of a better term, kind of comes into it.
Yeah. And you've also delved into this exploration of Orientalism and queer representation within art history. What drew you to kind of seek out this alternative representation within art history, especially off the back of this interest and young exposure of these historical paintings and old masters?
I think that it does exist. It probably, you know, in the same way that I experience and like kind of devour film and popular culture and like trying to sort of see representation or, you know, maybe seeing sort of a mirroring of myself in a historical context to sort of almost like validate and kind of placate who and where I am, you know? So I think for me, a lot of it has to do with a residency that I did a few years ago in Indonesia. And I guess I was just really thinking about, you know, how I can be in a space and then respond to it in an authentic way. And that was a lot to, you know, kind of formulating a body of work where it was about East-West, you know, holidaying, residencies, and then this kind of like historical academicism, which kind of comes across from that. So this like grand tour, you know, kind of artists back in the day that kind of went to these Eastern, and it's, you know, like 90-something% of the time kind of one direction, you know, and they sort of fetishized and exoticized the, you know, capital O other. So I think that that was a body of work that I was really visually, you know, engaged within, because they're, you know, they are very beautiful rendered surfaces, but then also quite kind of problematic in terms of its, I guess sort of exoticizing that other that I sort of mentioned. So I think coming to that concept as for a body of work from a perspective of kind of studying these sort of like historical paintings kind of inspired like that side of the body of work at Gus Fischer, and then a more recent exhibition last year back in Nam, where it was more kind of like a historical lens over a queer kind of correspondence, which was the name of the show. So sort of almost like kind of plotting a timeline through photographic work, painting, film, pornography, you know. So this show sort of collapses those two towers together, I think, or attempts to kind of, yeah, have that homoerotic orientalist as a subject.
Within this body of work, you really pull these interests together, resulting in these gorgeous works that in turn grapple with this entrenched hetero and ethnocentric hierarchies of the Western art canon. What was the process like for you kind of approaching this topic alongside the making of your work?
I guess in a practical kind of way, I try to sort of, it's almost like, you know, getting all the kind of ingredients together to like know that it's going to taste good. Sorry, this is how I talk to students sometimes. Yeah, who doesn't? And I think that that's what I sort of try to gather, because the outcomes for me between exhibitions can be kind of vastly different and also sort of kind of new and surprising. So I try to kind of almost like problem solve beforehand, which is where the research comes in for a while. And I did that before I went on another residency in Italy. So I guess I wanted, you know, being in that kind of very heavy sort of space and making this body of work.
Very historically loaded space.
Totally, yeah. And not just, I mean, it was actually not easy to find a lot of Orientalist works, because most of their collections were a lot more kind of, you know, ancient, for lack of a better word. So I think it was more just like even the way that I was painting and I guess bending the concept to facilitate the surface was a bit more kind of interesting being in such a, you know, like old, traditional sort of space. So I guess, the research and kind of bringing together those ideas and then sort of it forming a body of work which I guess, tries to speak of what you kind of were saying before, this like hetero and ethnocentric ways of looking at Orientalist and queer representation throughout history.
And the subject matter for the show is so enriched with all these layers of references and context. Do you want to speak to me a little bit about the subject matter and imagery used within the works? How did you piece together and form these really theatrical kind of scenes that you use?
I think I felt like being inspired by compositional and allegorical kind of markers in Europe was something that I was waiting to kind of, to wait until I was there.
Yeah.
Beforehand, it was a bit, I guess, when I think of a body of work, I kind of know how many works I'm going to do, kind of what they are of, and then finding the images to sort of be collaged onto a surface is like, maybe like not the most frustrating part, but it's equally, it's not frustrating, it's exciting, but it's also a bit, I guess, somewhat, that's this like a bit of the studio practice where it's like not even actually painting, it's kind of finding all these things. So the references for me don't have any kind of hierarchical structure, like some are AI, kind of fetishizing Instagram account generated images, some are AI that I've generated, which from the free programs weren't so successful, but others are historical paintings, some are stock images found on the internet, photographs that I've taken. Yeah, so I think I kind of try to put those together and then have a body of work which probably looks to more traditional, expected, kind of scenography. So, like bathhouses, pastoral scenes, marketplaces, souks, things like this. So I guess like having a body of work that sort of ticks boxes for these different pillars is that first step, and then gathering images. Funnily enough, maybe, the painting is the most sort of... like 1 + 1 = 2 for me.
It seems like you do like a lot of groundwork and a lot of research before you get to that act of actually the paintbrush in hand. And within the show, you have a mixture of both oil and ink on cotton and linen, as well as these breathtaking frescoes within the gallery space, each having a very different mode of application and in turn feeling. But firstly, I want to speak to the stretched works that are smaller in scale and offer a finer rendering of the image and a more expanded kind of theatrical environment to them. What was the kind of material process behind these works on canvas?
I know we'll get to that next, but painting in front of someone for me is so foreign. So, my studio kind of practice is quite...
And
just like I don't find it particularly interesting because it's just something that's so normal to me. But I think for other people it is, and people love seeing like a filthy palette and, like all the books that are like stuck together with the pages with all this like paint on it. And so I think I'm quite pretty, traditional. I'm not very clean in the studio. I don't, kind of wipe my palette and clean my brushes every day. Sorry, me. But, I think it's quite, in a way, the way that I was taught, which is also very traditional. So it's a reduced colour palette, white spectrum, yellow, red, blue, brown, and that's it.
Yeah, so adhering to these quite historical frameworks and techniques, like
totally.
You're using all of those kind of that layers.
100%, yeah. To the point where I become, because my attention span I find is so short, that when I get bored of a process, then that's kind of where it stops on the surface as well. Mm. So, you know, like if I, in the past, and also, you know, like for me, painting someone else's painting is the same thing as painting an image, you know, like, so I think when people have, I guess, maybe sort of coined the word copy, reproduction, et cetera, you know, for works that I've done, you know, they'll always ask how long it takes and, you know, it's so much shorter because I'm not doing it properly, you know, like I think that for me is important, that it keeps the rigor and kind of interest in and on the surface. And in the studio too.
Mm, yeah. And these frescoes, which are kind of almost a complete opposite, they offer a much more sporadic and heated energy about them, embedded with layered materiality and the tracing of your movement along the wall. The pictorial scene is also way more zoomed in with the figures dominating the works. And they also feel a bit more contemporary in their imagery and pictorial scenes, which I think is really interesting by pairing them with this historical framework of that fresco on the wall. Yeah, can you tell me a bit about the making process behind the frescoes compared to that of the canvas and how that... Yeah, that shift in application and subject matter that they take on.
Mm. Yeah, I think that for a lot of the work that I produce, I sort of like this gymnastic energy between and within exhibition. Mm. I think that that kind of, you know, even to a degree maybe, you know, like something for everyone. So yeah. I find that like, and for me too, you know, like I can't do the same thing over and over again. Like I said, the attention span.
Yeah, because your detailed ones, it's very time consuming. Yeah.
Totally. And I think that I find detailed smaller works kind of weirdly relaxing. The more kind of larger ones are much more obviously physical as well. I think with the fresco works, I guess I just really, you know, being in that incredible space of Gus Fischer and also having so much great support, shout out Gus Fischer, install crew and also staff there. Like, yeah, it was kind of something, I guess, that I liked conceptually, but then also wanted to, I guess, I don't want to say challenge, but maybe sort of froth up the expectation of what subject is on a fresco. Mm. So they're both screenshots from queer movies that deal with, I think, othering, both sexually and, I guess, you know, like in people's identity as well. Mm. So I think they kind of made sense to kind of be flanked alongside the smaller works because they operate in the same way, but I think visually quite different. So as like, I guess, a wall, you know, like an environment within a space to sort of house these other more sort of, you know, formal works, I think, for me, kind of had that idea of, like thinking that a body of work was hopefully a bit more dynamic than more sort of monosyllabic in its kind of expectation of one thing to the other.
Yeah, I also really like, how those imageries are the more contemporary references. And I think maybe normally with a fresco, it being on the ceiling and they're high, they're often in a place of, they seem like they're in a position higher. Mm-hmm. They've got this hierarchical thing, but the space that they're in, even though they do go up that height, they've got also the feeling of like being amongst, which I think I really like, that they're like with the people walking around the space, it has got that extra layer of closeness.
Yeah. Like it was interesting, even just you saying that now kind of made me sort of go like, you know, go back to, you know, there's frescoes everywhere, but like, you know, I think graffiti on walls also a type of that same thing.
It's kind of evolved, eh?
Yeah. But I think this kind of idea of it being grander, you know, like especially sort of like bending to the architecture of these sort of grand spaces too, I find kind of interesting. And I guess, you know, sort of strangely, like I didn't really expect it, even though they're obviously stills from film, where they do come across as quite cinematic as well. And maybe that has to do with, you know, if people go and see it, like the colour of the walls, which was also a nod towards, you know, this sort of like blushed stone kind of, you know, which is very synonymous with like colonized sort of museums and collections that house these works as well. So I think that, I feel like that kind of idea of scale and, you know, operates within and between also the two bodies of work, which is the same body for me, in also like how the smaller ones are quite small, you know, like, and they're kind of, you know, cropped on purpose as well. So they are more intimate.
And like a different, the fresco is like approaching that idea of intimacy in different ways,
totally.
Which is really lovely. And for those frescoes, did you use that traditional technique of, was it lime?
I did to a degree where I was like, yeah, that's right. It was like a lime plaster substrate, and then got some bulking egg yolk protein powder. Instead of using traditional...
Yeah, I was going to say, did you?
It's the same thing, really. Yeah.
Yeah, so tedious that separating the
egg
white.
Yeah, no, I think because I was using so much of it, or what I thought would be like a few kilos. It was interesting, like I've never really worked with... I've always worked with paint from a tube. I haven't kind of gone full trad and like ground my, you know.
So it's
yeah, it's not that performative in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a much more fast strain medium.
Totally, yeah.
So I think that really shows in the finished result of the work. It's so much more lively and fast, and
totally.
You can really see the brush strokes.
Yeah, for me, I think using scale and then working with the materials and even things like brushes as well. So, like, the brushes I was using were, like, some even as big as, you know, like a roller.
Wow,
and
yeah.
I think for me that was important to sort of show that gesture and immediacy on the surface as opposed to sort of this more tedious and kind of insular kind of hand finger work even, you know.
How did you find the works to be, like sitting together in space with those quite really different applications? Are you interested in this conversation between different modes of application and what it can do to the exploration of the themes and imagery that you use?
Yeah, I think for me it's like that I'm still interested in the making process, and hopefully the viewer can, I don't know about challenged, but I think within that experiential sort of realm that it isn't so repetitive. So I think that the conversations between the subjects of the smaller works and the subjects of the bigger ones and then the two different visual kind of bodies of work, I think that, you know, like I guess I sort of aim for exhibitions to kind of have that narrative as something that's a bit hot, you know, and kind of, you know, works and, you know, kind of like that engine kind of, you know, runs within the experience of the show and not just the subject of the works beforehand.
That was Gian Manick speaking to me about his work within Dreaming From Afar, which is currently on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 2nd of May. It's, so beautiful. Be sure to go check that one out.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
We've now got a song by Erica Badu, Didn't You Know? And, you're listening to various artists, and make sure you stick around.
like to play Minecraft and listening to 95BFM.
Sparrows, if you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95BFM.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums, and more.
I believe in like the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
You ready to play?
Yeah. I've just got to piss real quick. All right. Showtime. 95BFM Drive Live. Trillions of listeners will hear me. I'll finally make Mum proud if she listens. Maybe Freddie will listen and finally think I'm hot and cool and lovable. Oh, come on.
Hurry up.
Okay, this is it. Time to shine. Crap! No toilet paper.
Tune in every Friday live. Music beaming in direct from 95BFM Drive. Friday live on 95BFM. Thanks to McLeod's Brewery and NZ On Air.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost.
The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. Right here on 95BFM.
What's it all for?
Various artists.
Currently showing at Michael Lett Gallery is a restaging of Julian Dashba's Mid-Career Survey exhibition, Midwestern Unlike You and Me, which originally toured the American Midwest in 2005 and 6. Curated by Christopher Cook and David Raskin, the exhibition was and is the first and only time a survey exhibition of a New Zealand artist has toured the United States. Dashba was regarded as one of Aotearoa's most well-known contemporary artists. Being a primarily conceptually based artist, his work has often been described as being intertwined with this dialogue with other artists in art history, both internationally and locally, placing Aotearoa's geographical positioning at the centre of his practice as he explored these ideas of international styles, visual cultures, and repositioning the art world's institutional framework through his varied materiality. Marking 20 years since a significant moment in Dashba's career, Midwestern Unlike You and Me at Michael Lett brings together around 50 works and objects, many of which have not been seen publicly since the exhibition's American tour. I had a corridor with co-director of Michael Lett, Andrew Thomas, about the show and Dashba's life and practice more generally.
Julian was an artist who was born in Auckland, born in 1960 on a leap day. So, you know, perhaps he was special right from the start. He started at Elam and he sort of became known for making these expressionist paintings in the mid to late 1980s. And these paintings sort of appeared very much of their time, and they were, but they were also underpinned by this kind of conceptual logic. And then moving into the 90s, that concept-based approach to making art sort of ramped up a bit for him, and the work started to take on more of a refined, minimal aesthetic. And he worked with a variety of mediums, from painting, sculpture, photography, video, and sound. And, yeah, the work really encouraged a kind of mindful or cognitive art experience. But Julian was also very keen on making sure that the work was good to look at and could equally be enjoyed on that level. He sadly passed away too young, 2009. He was in his late 40s. That's a little brief intro to Julian's work.
Currently showing at Michael Lett is a restaging of Dashba's Mid-Career Survey exhibition, Midwestern Unlike You and Me, which, curated by Christopher Cook and David Raskin, originally toured the American Midwest in 2005 and 6. The exhibition was quite significant in the sense that it was the first and possibly only time a survey of a New Zealand artist has toured the States. And I guess to introduce the show, would you like to begin by speaking a little to the history behind the exhibition and what prompted a restaging of it at Michael Lett 20 or so years later?
Yeah, well, the show sort of came about through a meeting with curator David Raskin. And when Julian had a residency and an exhibition in Martha in 2001, and David and Julian met and they began talking about the work, and I guess one thing led to another and ended with, or culminated with, this show. So, as you say, opened in Sioux City, Iowa in 2005, and then travelled to museums in Nebraska and in Kansas. And I think to this day it is the only kind of travelling survey show of work by New Zealand artists in an American museum. And it was a survey that covered 25 years worth of Julian's work at that point. So it was a kind of large and significant show. And it was an exhibition, of course, that Julian took very seriously. There's a great catalogue. It has a really good interview in it. And in terms of why we have restaged it now, I think it's been an idea that has been sort of bubbling away for a little while. We've worked with Julian for some time now at the gallery, and I think when you work with an artist's estate, the role of the gallery is perhaps a little different to when you're working with living artists. It's kind of less about supporting the production of new work. It's a little bit more about legacy. And we've done various things over the years with Julian's work. We've made exhibitions that focus on particular moments. We've put his work in conversation with other artists. But, it has sort of been an idea that it might be possible to recreate this show. Yeah, the fact that it's kind of the 20th anniversary made it feel like it was something that we should look into a bit more seriously. And in doing that, it kind of seemed like it would be possible to bring the majority of these works back together.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear a little bit more, I guess, about how you went from we should restage the show to actually doing that in practice, because in surveying his practice, the show does feature around 50 works and objects of his career, some of which haven't been exhibited since 2006. Are you able to speak to the process of acquiring works and how you went about restaging the show in the space at Michael Lett?
Yeah, well, the catalogue for the original show has a very kind of handily has a list of all of the works that were included in the show in the back. So that was really the starting point. And then from there, we sort of looked at what needed to come from where. And there are some works in the show that have been borrowed from public and private collections, but a lot of the work also comes from the estate. And, I mean, I should say that bringing these works back together would not be possible without the kind of very careful and meticulous work that Marie Shannon had done over the years with Julian's estate. So that kind of made it actually relatively easy. And we have made some changes to the gallery. It's a bigger show perhaps than we might normally present in this space, so we've kind of expanded the gallery a little bit into a space that we don't always use for exhibitions, and then another space upstairs as well. We've built another wall in the space to kind of accommodate some of the work. So yeah, it feels like a very nice way to start our program for the year.
Julian Dashwood's practice manifested itself in many different forms, exploring his subject matter through abstraction, paintings, audio, sculpture, moving images and more, which can particularly be seen in this show. Are you able to speak to these various uses of material in the show and how materiality was approached by Dashwood?
Yeah, there are a variety of materials in the show. I think that the subject of Julian's work was art and the art world, and that is the source for a lot of the material. I think that he did very kind of easily move between making paintings and photographs and these sound works, but they are all underpinned by this kind of logic that runs through them all. And I think there are instances where he sort of stumbled on the use of these materials almost by accident. The slide works perhaps is an example of that. I don't think he set out to make work using slides as a material. I think through the natural kind of like day-to-day process of being an artist, those works came about quite naturally. I mean, this is, you know, we're going back to the days where artists would document their work using slides, and they would use those slides to send to dealers who would then perhaps, you know, subsequently show them to collectors, but they'd also be sent to curators, to various people who were interested in the work. So you had sort of multiple copies of these slides, and he one day got some slides back from the photographer and looked at the kind of sheet of slides and just, you know, it's almost like a light bulb moment, perhaps realised this is the work. So his choice and use of materials come from the art world, some perhaps more consciously than others, but I think Julian really considered, you know, like the whole art supply store as kind of world of opportunity.
Quite meta in a way.
Yeah, perhaps. There's also this interest in music, which kind of runs through the work, and the drumhead works, you know, drumheads are not something that come from an art supply store, but I think that music became an interesting analogy for him for a number of different reasons. And he started making drumheads in the early 90s and made them through until the kind of mid-2000s on and off, so for a period of around 15 years.
I want to, I guess, come back again to the original touring exhibition. What stood out to me is that in an advertisement for the show in Sioux City Art Centre and Art Forum in 2005, Dashba had asked that instead of a formal opening of the show, that people were requested to spend the 2 hours that they might have spent at an opening in the pursuit of intimacy with a close friend or loved one, dedicating themselves to developing deeper communication, vulnerability, openness, and conscious nurturing of that relationship. What can be said about the way that Dashba approached art and its surrounding community culture differently, or how he maybe challenged these frameworks?
Yeah, that's is a very beautiful thing. It's something that he first did for a show at Testrip, an artist-run space here in Auckland. And I think maybe more than a challenge, Julian embraced the conventions of the art world and he used them for his own purposes.
Mm.
I think that particular pursuit of intimacy. Yeah, look, I think in many different ways, Julian was a great connector of people. And he, I think there is something about that work and that sentiment that perhaps allowed people to participate in the exhibition in Sioux City and the exhibition at Testrip from locations that were kind of far beyond the kind of specificity of the audience and where the show was located. And I think that idea of connectivity and of being kind of from a certain place but allowing the work to have an audience that is much bigger than that was always such a big part of Julian's work.
I guess off the back of that, how do you kind of see these grounding ideas of his practice sitting within the context of today? Do you think that they can be considered in a similar way to 20 years ago, or do you feel like time has maybe shifted our interpretation of them?
That's a good question. I think there are things that remain the same, and I think there are things that are different. I think that the ideas that Julian was kind of thinking about in terms of New Zealand's relative geographic isolation from art world centres still exists, and I think it is still a challenge for artists to be from here and to have a career that exists outside of this part of the world but also maintain a connection to home. But I think that kind of, yeah, conversely, I think that New Zealand is perhaps less marginalised than it was. I mean, for example, one of the works in the show is Julian's Art Forum pieces, where he placed his own work into Art Forum magazine, and then as a sort of travelling exhibition, if you like, and then in a subsequent issue followed that up with a review of that show. And I think this was in the early 1990s, and at that time I think he felt that as being an artist from New Zealand, the only way to get that kind of attention from a magazine like that was essentially to pay for it and make it happen himself. But now Art Forum does review exhibitions that happen in New Zealand by New Zealand artists, and I think that is a kind of big shift. I think that, you know, New Zealand artists winning the Golden Lion at Venice is something that perhaps Julian might not have predicted, but I think would be incredibly proud of. So I think that, yeah, there are things that have changed, but I think there are things about the work that are also still very relevant. And I think 20 years on from the show in Sioux City, there hasn't been a retrospective survey of his work in an institution here in New Zealand. And I think for that reason, there is perhaps a younger generation here who are aware of Julian's work but don't quite have all the pieces of the puzzle. And yeah, perhaps restaging the show as a way to kind of start putting those pieces together to a certain extent for a younger audience. But I do hope that that task is kind of picked up in a bigger way by an institution here in New Zealand. The exhibition closes on the 7th of March. The weekend before that, Saturday the 28th of February, Christina Barton is going to give a talk in the gallery where she discusses Future Call, a great work of Julian. I would encourage people to come to that if they are able to. And being the 28th of February, that is also a day where we are going to celebrate Julian's birthday, which of course was on a leap day, so it would be on the 29th if it was a leap year. But yeah, I think that will be a nice day in the gallery. Celebrate the show, celebrate Julian, hear from Tina, who did work with Julian a lot over the years and knows the practice very well.
That was co-director of Michael Lett Gallery, Andrew Thomas, speaking to me about Julian Dashba's Midwestern Unlike You and Me. The exhibition is on at Michael Lett until the 7th of March.
Because we were feeling a little extra, a little cunty.
You're on Various Artists here on BFM. We will be right back for your arts guide.
BFM.
Oh, I love this song.
Straight back to you. I know where you live. I used to live there too.
It's the 95BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in there.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Dreaming From Afar, a group show exhibiting Brunel Diaz Prims, Gian Manick and Tyrone Tewa, is on at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 2nd of May.
As also mentioned on the show, Julian Dashba's Midwestern Unlike You and Me is on at Michael Lett until the 7th of March.
Fiona Connor's Blanket Games is on at Coastal Signs until the 14th of March.
Justin Tenney's Engine is on at Treadler until the 13th of March.
Yvonne Todd's Diary of a Carrot is on at the Arts House Trust at Pa Homestead until the 22nd of March.
Gordon Bennett and Emily Karaka After the Undercurrents is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 11th of April.
Portal is currently on at The Kit, located in the basement of Artspace Aotearoa, and is on until the 21st of February.
Grace Terry's solo exhibition To Look Twice is on at Melanie Roger Gallery until the 6th of March.
Maramataka, a group show of artworks by 12 Māori artists, is on at Tim Melville Gallery until the 7th of March.
And Te Mauri o Te Wai, a solo exhibition by Sky Lunson Story, is on at Window Gallery until the 18th of March. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kore o mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Andrew Thomas.
And Gian Manick.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātoa, te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Nigel. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.